We're looking at battle armor, and we're looking in Ephesians chapter 6 to the passage that says this. Let me read it to you. Verse 16. Above all, take the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. Again, this passage is talking about the wiles of Satan, what Satan's trying to do in my life and in yours. And so he says, and let me read it again, above all, I think that's an important phrase, of all the things I've talked about, above all, take the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. One of the shows my wife and I watch now and then, we watch it more than other shows, is 48 Hours. Now, 48 Hours comes on Saturday nights at 10 o'clock, and it's essentially about men who kill their wives but don't get away with it. And so if I'm late for the show, you know, 10 minutes in, it's like, how'd he kill her tonight, you know, because that's about all that there is on 48 Hours. And I shouldn't share this, but it's Sunday night, but I was talking to a woman, and she was in New York City listening to a African-American comedian, and she was joking about the differences in African-American gentlemen and white gentlemen, and she referenced 48 Hours, and she said, you know, African-American gentlemen, they don't do all this or that, and then she said, but white guys, they're really romantic, except for one thing, they will kill you, and so anyway, 48 Hours is always husbands killing wives. But we were watching one night, and it was a rare exception because it didn't have anything to do with murder. It was about a guy named Steve Trantle, and he was married to a woman named Jeannie, and Steve was born in New York City, and he and his wife moved out to Rockville Center on the island of Manhattan, as I understand it. And he began a career as a trader on Wall Street and had a very successful career on Wall Street. And they were able to have a very nice family life, at least financially. Things went very well. His wife did not work. He was able to, through his work on Wall Street, she was able to maintain a lifestyle that was very much at ease. And she enjoyed the money that came in, and apparently he enjoyed making it. But at some point, he was arrested, and the reason he was arrested was for bank robbery. And what had happened was a few months or a few years before that time, his wife doesn't know. She thinks he's working on Wall Street. He had lost his job. And so that he could keep his family up to the living standards they had grown accustomed to, he began robbing banks and bringing home the money, giving it to her and paying their bills. And I'm watching this story, and from a pastoral perspective, you're saying, you know, if this guy loses his job, he comes into my office, what do you tell him? And it seems to me that one of the things that I would tell him is what this passage says. Above all, take the shield of faith by which you will be able to quench the fiery darts of the wicked one. Because if you think about it, Christians lose their jobs too. Sometimes the marriages of Christians get very rocky. Sometimes, on rare occasion, they can end in divorce. The children of Christians oftentimes go wayward. Not often, but it happens. Bad things happen to Christians, like they did this gentleman, Steve Trantle. Life seems to cave in. And it seems to me that for those who are in those situations, this verse has a lot to say. Above all, above everything else Paul's been talking about, above all, take the shield of faith by which you can quench the fiery darts of the wicked one. Let me explain. This shield is a very specific kind of shield. In the Greek language, is called a scutum. I don't know how the U is pronounced there. But anyway, it's a shield. It's very specific. It's not the shield that a sword fighter would use, that sometimes you see in movies where it's a small shield and they would have on their right arm as they're fighting with their left or vice versa. But this is the shield that sometimes you see in old movies. It tended to be 2.5 feet wide by 4.5 feet tall. And it was like a small door. It tended to be wood. It would have leather on the front. It would have metal around the edges. Sometimes it would be ornate. And there was a statement among the Romans that when you went into war, you either came back with your shield or you came back on your shield. And that's the way that oftentimes they would carry people back who had been killed. It was specific. You wouldn't use this shield at all times. You'd have your sword, your helmet, your shoes on at all times, but this was a very significant piece of armor. You would only use it when you were in the heat of the battle, and you would use it usually during a siege. You would be going up against the wall of a town, or perhaps you would be trying to take a hill, and it was at that time that you would take this shield, 2.5 feet by 4.5 feet, and you would march behind it. The idea was you could get your entire body behind it. The reason you wanted to get your entire body behind it was because of what the passage references. There would be fiery darts coming at you in close range. These fiery darts had tar on the end, and they were lit aflame. And so literally when the fiery darts are coming, the shoes aren't going to help you. The helmet's really not going to help you. Your sword is not going to help you. Your breastplate really isn't going to help you if you get hit by one of these darts, because again, the breastplates were links of metal, and the whole ideal of taking a ball of tar and lighting it on fire is that if it hits you, the tar will go beneath the breastplate. It will seep through the holes of your breastplate. And so if you get hit by one of these darts, again, the breastplate isn't going to be helpful. And it will literally light you on fire if you get hit by one of these darts, which is a gruesome way to die. I have a friend who pastors in town that you would be well aware of, Rick Ballard. And we went to seminary together, and I remember talking to Rick one morning, and he was in complete shock. There was a car wreck in front of his house. He lived in a farmhouse, and it was a country road, and a car went off the ditch across the road from his house at about 3 o'clock a.m., and Rick just hears this noise. He gets on his coat, he goes out, and the car had flipped over on its side, and it was already on fire. The man inside was trapped. He could not get out. The car had been crushed down a bit, but he was still in the seatbelt. And Rick was trying to get him out when it hit maybe the gas line, and the car just burst into flames, and it was a brutal thing to stand there and not be able to get the man out and watch the man burn to death just in front of him. Brutal way to pass. And that's what would happen if you were hit with the fiery darts. Again, nothing else is going to help you in that situation. And so you take the shield, and he says, that's the shield of faith. Now, what are the fiery darts? And again, there's room here because sometimes this isn't well defined. This is sort of an analogy. Martin Luther believed, as others did, that the fiery darts were doubts. Martin Luther was a man who I think had his own fiery darts, and perhaps from his own life he interprets scripture here. He was fighting a whole system of religion in his day, and Martin Luther, the great reformer, rose up and tacked the 95 theses on the wall, and single-handedly, at least at the first, he went up against the entire Roman Catholic Church. And Martin Luther would hear frequently something to this effect: Martin, are you alone wise, and the wisdom of all the ages wrong? And you think about that. Here's a man, And he is standing up against organized religion, against 1,000 years of organized religion. And he is saying, it's all wrong. I know more than the last 1,000 years of Catholic theologians. I know more than the Pope. I know more than the cardinals. I know more than the priests. I can tell you that this is wrong where you guys can't see that it's wrong. And again, they would attack him and say, Luther, where did all the pride come from? Is everybody wrong but you? And in his private time, there was doubts that God was using him, that God was really speaking to him, that God was going to work this out for the good. And others have said these darts are doubts. Now, Scripture tends to say, and something else here, oftentimes in Scripture, fire is trouble in general. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 12, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12 and 13, if it's on the screen, this is what Peter said, Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. So here's Peter talking about fiery trials, and he's talking about these trials would be the equivalent of suffering with Christ. In the book of Revelation, the churches are told that they will go through the fire. You have it also in Isaiah and in many other places where fire is troubles. Well, let me put those two things together. It seems to me that what the fiery darts are, from my perspective, and let me explain after I say this, are the doubts specifically about the goodness of God that comes upon Christians in difficult times. When you talk about the fiery dart, it's doubts about the goodness of God, or doubts about what God is doing, that come upon Christians, brought on by Satan, by the way, this is a scheme of Satan, that comes upon Christians during difficult places in life. Okay. Seems to be that that's the way Satan works. I mean, take the three great conversations we have of Satan in the Bible. The first one would be in Genesis chapter 3 with Eve. The second one would be with God concerning Job. The third one would be the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. So take the situation with Eve. Now this isn't a difficult place for Eve. The other two I think are. But how does Satan tempt Eve? And I think we've talked about that before. What does he come? What does he say? He says essentially to her, God is punishing you. He knows that if you eat from the tree of good and evil, that you'll become like him, and he doesn't want you to become like him. That's the insinuation. And so what God is trying to do is to keep you from something good, something that would actually help your life, something that would help you to become like him. What's Satan doing there? With Eve, he's coming to her and he is casting doubts about God's goodness in her life. He's coming to her and he's casting doubts about the character of God. He is shooting a dart. He is shooting a doubt specifically about what God intends to do in her life. You look at the situation with Job, and Satan comes to God and he wants to try Job, and Job has a blessed life. God has blessed him with 10 wonderful children. God has blessed him financially. God has blessed him with health. And Satan comes to God and he essentially says, let me try Job. Let me take away every good thing he's got. Because I'm telling you that if you take away every good thing he's got, he will doubt your goodness. He will curse you. The only reason Job serves you, Satan says, is because you've been good to him. If you put him in the fire, if you put him in the midst of a trial, trust me, God, Satan says, he will curse you. He will cave. He will doubt your goodness if you stick him in the furnace. Now, Satan's a master tempter. He knows the human condition. He knows how we think. And notice how he is diagnosing the human condition. He's saying, listen, Job is a great man, but if you'll set up a trial, if you'll put him in the fire, if you'll put him on a series of losses, he will question the goodness of God. That's what he'll do. He'll curse you. You come to Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. It's interesting how that story sits up, or that account, because the last verse of Matthew chapter 3, Jesus has been baptized, and from heaven we hear, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. That's the last verse of chapter 3 of Matthew. And then comes the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. Immediately, he's driven into the wilderness. I think that's significant, by the way, and this is just a rabbit trail here. But immediately after he reaches the spiritual peak, he's baptized. This is my beloved Son from God. He experiences tremendous temptation immediately following that. And sometimes you need to understand that. You may be gloriously saved today and experience the greatest temptation of your life tomorrow. Immediately, he's driven into the wilderness. And in verses 3 and 6, what does Satan say to him? He sets him up with three temptations, but he says this twice, verse 3 and 6 of Matthew 4. He says, how does he say it? Essentially, he says, if you are who God says you are. Let me get it exact tonight. Verse 3 and 6. Satan says, all right. If you are the Son of God, command these stones become bread. That's verse 3. Verse 6, he says, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself off the pinnacle of the temple. Notice what he's saying. God has said, when he's baptized, you are my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Immediately Satan comes to him and says, if you are who God says you are. Notice that. He's fasting. There's this difficulty in Jesus' life. He's fasting. Immediately Satan comes and he says, listen, if God's telling the truth, if you are who God says you are, feed yourself. I mean, you're the Son of God. Why are you out here suffering like this? If God has told you the truth, if you are his son, if you're who you say you are, it shouldn't be any trouble for you to do a miracle here. It shouldn't be any trouble for you to cast yourself down and the angels will bear you up. If you are who you say or who he says you are. Notice how Satan works there. What's he doing? He's questioning God. He's saying, you know, you're in the middle of the wilderness. You're suffering. You're supposed to be the Son of God. Look at you. You don't even have anything to eat. Look at you. You're powerless. God said you're what? His son? It's the same thing Eve is being tempted with. Did God really say that? I mean, are you really looking? Because look at the situations that you're in, Jesus. It doesn't look to me like you're the Son of God. If you are the Son of God, then you ought to be able to do these things, so do them. Again, that's a temptation that you and I face. In a subtle way. You're a Christian. You've been adopted into the family. Your father owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, and he owns the hills to boot. If he is who he says he is, if you are who he says you are, why in the world does your life look like it does? Why is it so difficult for you? And see, that's a ploy of Satan. It's a fiery dart. Now, those darts come in difficult places in life, but there are doubts, oftentimes doubts about the goodness of God. Now, I want you to see how important it is to be aware of this. Because again, you notice in verse 16 there, he says, above all, hold up the shield of faith. I think this is why it's above all. I think you could argue, and I think what Paul is saying here is that this is the most important piece. And this is why. If you begin to have doubts about the goodness of God in your life, if you begin to have doubts about the wisdom of God, if you begin to have doubts about God's intention to you, nothing else in the faith can save you. Nothing else can save you. I mean, think about armor here. He said, put on truth. Sorry, my mind's not as working for me tonight. Put on truth. Having girded your waist with truth. It says, put on truth. Gird your waist with a commitment. Take on yourself a commitment to tell the truth, a commitment to doing the truth, a commitment to valuing truth. Put that on. But what happens in your life if you begin to doubt the goodness of God? If you doubt the goodness of God, your commitment to truth will begin to waver. Begin to waver. I mean, if you're going through a financial place in your life, or your business is failing, or you're experiencing difficulties, you're losing in life, you're on a winning streak, and now you're losing. If you ever begin to doubt that God is working this out to your good, if you look at all the things that you're losing in the struggle, and you begin to doubt God's goodness, you begin to think that God isn't mindful of you, that God doesn't see what you're going through, you know what you'll do? You'll be tempted to lie your way out of it. Tempted to lie your way out of it. Business is failing. Where's God at? My business is failing. Where's God at? And you'll begin to cheat at your business. I mean, you'll begin to say, God isn't going to help me. I've got to help myself. And your commitment to truth will begin to waver. Think about the breastplate of righteousness, or a commitment to do what's right in any situation. That won't hold if the shield fails. If you're a single person, you want to be married, or you want to have a family, but you're single, and so because you're single, you have a commitment to purity. You have a commitment to keeping yourself sexually pure. And that's just something that is important to you, and so you've made that commitment. But what happens if you begin to think God's forgotten about you? Or that God really isn't mindful, or God doesn't really care about your loneliness. God isn't mindful of your struggle. You go to church, they do a child dedication, and everybody thinks it's cute, but you sit back there saying, I'd like to have a kid. I'd like to have a husband. I'd like to have a wife, and I don't see anything happening in my life. I'm serving the Lord. I'm doing what's right, and it seems like I'm destined to grow old alone. If you begin to doubt that God is for you, you know what? Your commitment to purity will stop. It begin to stop. I've known people, and I've known girls who were in church, and they're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. Great girls, faithful to this church. They want to be married. They want a husband. 24, 25, nothing's happening. They look around and they say, you know, the only girls that are getting married are the ones that are partying, the ones that are compromising their virtue. And you oftentimes see that they begin to make compromises in their own life. I know they want to be married. I know that they want a family. But because they doubted that God was for them, that God was working this out, that God hadn't forgot that they're 25 and single, their compromise to righteousness begin to fade. Your commitment to righteousness won't hold if you doubt that God is working for you. Think about the shoes of peace. Your commitment to peace will fade again if you don't trust that God is mindful of you. Somebody hurts you, somebody wrongs you, you are hurt. It's a real pain. You are wounded by what folks said. You do care. You are limp. It has been painful. If you don't fully believe that God can work this to the good and that He will as you commit it to Him, you know what? Your commitment to peace will happen and vengeance is mine, you'll say. I've got to get them. God isn't going to work this out. God's forgotten about me. I'm supposed to be a child of God. People are not treating me like this. And see, when you begin to doubt the justice, the wisdom, the character, the concern of God in your life, that strikes you like a fiery dart. And it doesn't matter about the shoes of peace. In some ways, it doesn't even matter about the breastplate of righteousness. In some ways, it doesn't even matter. And we'll talk about the helmet next week. Those things begin to collapse if the shield is lost. Because you lose the shield, the fiery darts, all those things aren't going to help you if the fiery dart strikes you. But if you hold the shield up, you're going through those difficulties. You can pray, Lord, you see what's happening in my life. It seems like I'm about to lose everything. Everything I've worked for. And you know what? I could probably keep it if I would just misrepresent the truth. If I would do away with honesty, my business would be better. I would be able to move forward in life. I could hold what I've worked for. But you're for me. You're not against me. You are allowing this to come on me. And if I'm supposed to be a modern day Job, I'll be a modern day Job. But I know that when I am finished in this fire, I will come out as pure gold. I don't doubt your goodness. I don't doubt your wisdom. I'm going to walk by faith. I'm not going to walk by sight. And what are you doing? You're holding up the shield. The faith is holding. If you're single and you say, you know, listen, all the happy people, where do they all come from? Not me. I want a family. I want a marriage. I didn't think that I would be in my mid-20s and be having this situation. I certainly didn't think I'd be 30, this situation. Everybody I see getting married are coincidentally compromising their virtue. But you have a plan for me. I don't know what it is, but you have a plan for me. And maybe your plan is to make me the happiest single person that ever lived. I don't know. But you are going to work this to my good. I don't question your wisdom. I don't question your faith. I don't question your timing. I don't question your love for me. What are you doing there? You're holding up the shield. That fiery dart can't get into you. Again, you know, people are wronging you. People are after you. People are abusing you. People are misrepresenting you. When you look at those situations and you're able to say, Lord, I'm hurt. I'm broken. I'm struggling. But you haven't forgotten about me. You love me as much today as you love me when things are going well. You are still just. Your promises to right these wrongs still hold. And I don't question your timing. I don't question your timing. I'm trusting in you. Again, I'm walking by faith, not sight. You are holding up that shield. And as long as Satan can't get you to doubt the goodness and the wisdom and the justice of God, you're going to hold. You're going to hold in temptation. You'll be like Job. Job lost it all. He went through the fire. The dart came and he said, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. What are you seeing? You're seeing Job holding up the shield. He will not allow the character of God to take him down spiritually. He will not allow questions about the character. I think that's what that passage is saying. It's vital in difficult places to not allow Satan to sink that arrow into you, because it will burn out your relationship with God. He wants to sink it. That's the goal. It will come in the hottest fight. It's not going to come probably when things are easy. Again, this is sort of a temporary weapon. You only need it in the hottest fight. And again, when things are going well in your life, you're not questioning the goodness of God. When your life is really going well, you're not questioning His wisdom. When everybody's nice to you and people who aren't nice to you get their just desserts the next day, you're not questioning the judgment, the justice of God. In one sense, this shield, you sort of don't need it when things are going well. But it is in times of trial that those darts are going to fly. And that's where you have to take up that commitment that God knows more than you do. He loves you more than you can say. He's mindful of you. He has not forgotten you. And I know life doesn't look like things are going well, but again, I am going to hold up this shield, and it's going to get me through this difficult place in life. Amen. Let's stand.